Welcome back to TNT's Will Podcast, the official companion podcast of the TNT series Will. I'm your host, Michael Wood, and with me is the creator and executive producer of Will, Craig Pierce.
Hi, Michael. Great to be back.
Episode 8.
Yes.
A plague on both your houses.
Mm.
And you begin with the Pope and a letter from Rome.
Yes.
And a crucial, crucial moment, speaking with my historian's hat on, for the English Catholic community. Mm. And here's a country that have been Catholic for 1,000 years. The government is forcing these religious changes. The people are trying to accommodate. Families like the Shakespeares are trying to accommodate. Mm. And now the Pope's intervention, the excommunication of the Queen, puts English Catholics, loyal English Catholics, in an absolutely impossible situation, doesn't it? This ratchets up.
Yes.
That ratchets up the whole tension of the story, doesn't it?
Really? Yes, yes. The Pope issues a papal bull to say that the Queen is excommunicated, and really it's like a fatwa, in a sense. The Pope's saying, if you're a good Catholic, don't obey the Queen. And in fact, it would be quite a good idea to bump her off, get rid of her, because she's a false monarch. So, of course, this actually isn't the papal bull. We play with people's expectations. It's another thing entirely. But absolutely, there was communication coming between the Pope and the head of the Catholic mission in England. There's the secret underground Catholic priest network run at this time by Robert Southall. And it's also Alice becoming more deeply involved with working with Southall and also playing with this idea of that Alice starts the series as a little bit naive in the sense that she's looking for someone to partner with creatively in a broad sense, and that becomes Will. And that falls apart, and now she's looking for something post-Will. She's in a post-Will phase. The letter is it's a plot device, really, to show that Alice is becoming more deeply entrenched in the Catholic movement, and she's doing this very dangerous thing. She's becoming a spy for the Catholics. And I think, you know, what Alice is reacting against is her breakup with Will and realizing that actually she can't rely on a man for her self-worth and her happiness. And she's looking for something bigger in life. And she finds it through this very political religious cause. And, you know, of course, we see this around us today again and again and again. People who perhaps disaffected or disenfranchised, and they need a cause to believe in. And Southall becomes Alice's cause. And this is a very dangerous thing she's doing because, of course, you know, these kinds of activities were punishable by the most horrendous public executions.
And you, like a good Shakespearean, Craig, if I may say, then set up.
That's the highest form of praise you can give a writer. I'm not sure that I should accept it, but thank you.
Then you set up this parallel plot, which actually is an interweaving plot, and it's a really Shakespearean device, which is that the arch enemy, the baddie, Topcliffe, then commissions Shakespeare to write a play against his own cousin. It's like Beatrice saying, kill Claudio to kill your best friend in Much Ado About Nothing, isn't it? This classic Shakespearean device. And in order to do that, Will has to get into the mind of the torturer.
Mm. So Will's got to find a way out of that, of course. So he twists it by coming up with this idea that actually he's going to make Topcliffe the hero of the story. He's going to say to Topcliffe, you're going to be the hero of the story, but actually he's going to write really about Topcliffe. Now, this is a very dangerous thing to do because, of course, you couldn't write a political play. That also is punishable by death.
There's a censor.
There's a censor.
Your script has to pass the censor,
that's right,
doesn't it?
That's right. And it's very unlikely that it will get past the censor. And if it did, well, they'd all be hauled off to prison and tortured for writing about current political events. It's absolutely forbidden.
We know how closely the censor worked as well, don't we? There's a manuscript of a play that was never performed on a political subject, Sir Thomas More.
Mm.
And And the censor's remarks are on the manuscript.
Yeah.
And at one point he says, leave this in at your peril.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So this is a serious business, isn't it? How
Absolutely.
You frame a script
sure.
that can be read yeah. one way and be reread the
yeah.
other way.
Well, it really was a police state in many ways. So Will has to find a way around this problem. And, of course, in the episode, he comes up with the idea of making it a history play, but making it so recognizably about Richard Topliff that people will get it, that they will understand absolutely what he's writing about, even though it's set in the past like a myth.
Okay, so that plot line develops, as we've seen. Meantime,
yes, and of course, to get under Topliff's skin and really create the character of Richard III, Will has to seduce Topliff. So there are these dinners, you know, with Hitler, essentially, saying, well, you know, how do you do it? That must feel incredible. And this seduction of Topliff through appealing to his ego, it's a very dangerous and delicious dramatic game that Will has to play.
And maybe true, do you think, to... I always thought Shakespeare was a person who listened more than
yeah,
he talked. Don't you think?
I think so.
I kind of imagine Shakespeare at parties being the guy who's just standing there listening
yes,
and
yes.
Observing.
Absolutely.
He's fantastically good at, especially male speech, the way men are together.
Mm.
It's as if he's right from being a little kid listening to his dad and his dad's business colleagues. He's just
yes,
catches
yes,
that
yes.
way that people are.
Fantastic observation of character and dialogue and patterns of speech.
And he knows this kind of person, doesn't he? The Topcliff kind of person.
Mm. You see this person throughout his plays in various characters.
I mean, even today, the mentality of these people who justify torture on the grounds of religion or politics or whatever, we know them, don't we?
Sure.
You know, and very often it's to do with religion, isn't it?
Mm.
The theologian and the torturer or executioner kind of go hand in hand in a lot of history, don't they?
Well, I think what one of the things, many things that made Shakespeare such a great writer, but also such a modern writer in our sense of the word, is that he saw the inherent contradictions and hypocrisies in the human character and in politics, and the way that the people use good or God or the good of a nation or the good of a people to do the most extraordinarily cruel and barbaric things to one another. So he really was a truth teller, Shakespeare, and he just saw the inherent lies in those positions that the politicians or human beings often take.
He virtually never allows political rhetoric to stand uncritiqued, does he? Really?
No, you know? No. He doesn't let them get away with it.
Yeah. Okay. And Marlowe, we have to come back to Marlowe, don't we? He's kind of runs through the whole story. And in episode 8, you've got them working together even. And actually, it's really interesting you should do this, because literally while you've been editing these films, the scholars have come out with new computer analysis saying they did work together.
That's right.
I mean, two great things come out of this, I think. Number one is it's a really collaborative endeavour.
Hmm.
And we have this highfalutin idea that Shakespeare is this godlike artist where every word is kind of sacrosanct.
No.
Actually, they're in a business which is so fast turnover and high pressure that they collaborate all the time. I think a third of all Elizabethan plays are collaborations, aren't they?
Yeah.
And
well, that's why it was so like the movies and television. I mean, in creating this television show, I wrote the first episode on my own. I wrote the second episode on my own. I co-wrote the third episode. There was another writer who wrote the fourth episode, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I wrote various episodes. But being the, quote-unquote creator or author of the show, I oversaw the writing of all the episodes. But it was very collaborative. We had a four-person writer's room, myself being the fifth person, and you know, we would hash out all these stories and we would improve them and develop them. And it was incredibly collaborative. But it always is, and it always has been in one way or another, whether I've worked in film, television or theatre. So the performing arts, it's not like a novelist where you go away, you sit in your room, perhaps if you're lucky enough to have an editor, and eventually, you know, come out with a book. And I think this gives the great lie to the theory that Shakespeare wasn't Shakespeare, or Shakespeare didn't write the plays because, you need a new scene. Hang on, I'll just ride off to the Earl of Oxford and I'll see you in about 3 days' time. And, why are you going to the Earl of Oxford? No reason, but I'll just come back with a new scene. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. I mean, they couldn't wait for you know, it was very much in the moment. They were working so quickly. And he must have been, you know, they must have been all working together. I'm sure actors suggesting lines and how about I do this and, you know, oh, why don't we do that? It would have been very much flying by the seat of your pants in the moment kind of work. And, of course, Shakespeare would have edited and re-edited and refined his plays as he went along and as the performances developed, and he would have seen the performances and gone, it doesn't quite work. We need something in the third act. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this idea of the great genius sitting alone in his or her study producing these works in a vacuum, it just doesn't happen like that.
The scripts are worked on by the company, aren't they, and developed by the company. Mm-hmm. You see the different versions of Romeo and Juliet. You can see how they it's such a hit. And they see it in performance and they tour with it. And,
yes.
And they have to do long and short versions. You know, you're playing some small inn in kind of Rye or Hastings and you can't do a 3-hour show. You've got to time it. So I think they're always responding to circumstances, aren't they? Mm. And I totally agree with you. In fact, that was my second question really about this collaboration. Of course, it does show you that Shakespeare is not Marlowe and Marlowe is not Shakespeare.
Yeah.
As if we didn't know that. And when you read their plays, any fool can see that they're different writers.
Absolutely.
Different character,
absolutely.
Different everything, aren't
different
they?
Different concerns.
And different concerns. Mm. And,
Marlowe's never going to, you know, oh, Marlowe died young and he turned into Shakespeare. No, he never was Shakespeare. He was never writing. No.
It couldn't be sillier, that thesis, any more than the idea that a noble aristocrat wrote the Shakespeare plays. It's such nonsense, isn't it?
A boy who went to grammar school and who was in the theatre observing aristocrats is much more likely, and going to court and performing plays and, you know, reading the histories, is much more likely to know about the monarchy, because they're human beings at the end of the day, than an aristocrat is to know about all the common characters that Shakespeare wrote about.
In any case, the experts tell us, so I gather, that you can trawl the plays for all the texts that the author read, and the truth is that the author of Shakespeare's plays did the grammar school education up to about the age of 14 or 15 and didn't do the final year or two of grammar school, never went to university.
Thank goodness.
And is not an aristocrat. And, of course, it explains who he was, doesn't it? You know, the whole take of the plays is not...
And his great connection to the common person.
Yeah. The language of common people. Mm. He always has that, doesn't he? You know, right at the end of his career, you get those plays like Winter's Tale, which are being done for the indoor theatres with the candlelit and all the rest. But when the peasant comes on stage, totting up how much it's going to cost to buy the food for the... For the village feast.
Yes. Like Autolycus.
The sheep shearing, the tods of wool.
Yes.
The detail of the dialect, the local stuff. Mm. I'm glad we're not that on the head, though, Craig.
Yes, good.
We'll probably get a lot of emails and a lot of texts about this from nutty Shakespeare.
you can answer them,
deniers, but yes. Okay.
Well, and we should talk about Autolycus, too, because apart from the fact that everyone on the production cursed me for naming a character Autolycus, because no one could pronounce his name. He's a character. It's a name from The Winter's Tale. And, of course, Autolycus and Peg die from plague in episode 8. So, you know, that the title of Plague on Both Your Houses works on a number of different levels. You know, the Protestant and the Catholic houses, the playhouses, you know, the Rose and the theatre, who are rivals. But of course, you know, a reference to the plague, which was an ever constant danger in the Elizabethan world. And Autolycus, poor old Autolycus, who's been a bit of the lovable loser, you know, wonderful kind of best friend character, a really good hearted person, but a little bit unlucky in love, because always, you know, carries a candle for Alice, and he's very firmly in the friend zone with her, falls in love for the first time, is happy, really happy for the first time. But by the end of the episode, he and his beloved Peg contract plague. And it's a real turning point for Richard Burbage as a character, because Will comes to him in episode 8 and says, hey, I've got this incendiary idea. I'm going to write a play about Richard Topcliffe. How we're going to get away with it is I'm going to set it in the past. I'm going to call him Richard III. And Richard Burbage is just like, you're an idiot. That's really dangerous. It's brilliant, but it's too dangerous. I'm not going to do it. And Will challenges him and says, what do you believe in? He says, well, women, beer, fame. Did I mention women? At that moment, almost, Autolycus is discovered to be sick. They take Autolycus back and they would close up the plague houses for, you know, shut everyone up inside for 2 weeks until the contagion had passed. And Richard, in this very heroic act, realizes in that moment, this is what he believes in. Friendship, love for his friend. He was apprenticed, you know, as an actor with Autolycus at 12 years old. He goes into the plague house to be with his friend as he dies. But before he does, he says to Will, write me Richard, and when I get out, I'll play him.
Great. And we look forward to seeing that in the next episode.
Yes. Well, stay tuned.
Great.
Join me next Tuesday for an all-new episode of TNT's Will Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to TNT's Will Podcast in the Apple Podcasts app. And please leave a rating and a review while you're there. And remember, Will is all new Mondays at 9 on TNT. I'm Michael Wood. Thanks for listening.